This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2022, held at Faith Builders on August 2 through 5.
Well, good morning. It's good to be here, and I'm looking forward to this week, probably more than you are. I enjoy Teachers Weeks, and I always find I learn so much. I always take a chance on technology, and I've got an old computer here, and so we'll let the IT guys just run to it. What do you know? You know, he just pushes a button and it works. Isn't that great? That's why we need the younger people serving us with these kinds of things. This morning, we're looking at a metaphor, and in the next 4 days, we hope to look at four different metaphors. Now, these are not the only four. There are many, many metaphors that could be made. And this is a general session where we hope to share ideas and explore some ideas. So it's to help you think about what a teacher is. A teacher is many things. And it's hard to just pin it down and know how to describe a teacher and what our role is and how it all works. Now, you probably know what a metaphor is. Your fifth grade language teacher taught you about a metaphor, probably. It's where you call something that it isn't, just for sake of comparison and understanding. A metaphor is different than a simile in the sense that a simile uses like or as to compare things. Jesus used metaphors. Jesus used similes. Jesus said, "You are the light of the world." So we understand our work in the world. He said, "You're like a city on top of a hill that can't be hid." We kind of heard about that already this morning. He said, "You are salt." Now, you're really not salt, but it helps us to understand what we're supposed to do, what our job is. And that is what I would like to do in the next 4 days, is just consider some of the obscure aspects of what a teacher is and promote our thinking. Teachers are kings. Now, kings in medieval times is what I have in mind here. That type of top of the totem pole position, the one that led the country, the one that represented the country, the one that was over the kingdom. And you have a little picture there in your notes. That's the kind of king I think about as we are going to explore this metaphor. Teachers are kings. Now, in Canada, we have a queen. She lives in England, Queen Elizabeth II, an amazing person, and she has reigned for about 70 and a half years. On September the 6th, if my calculations are right, she will have reigned for 70 and a half years. Second only from known history. Now, there are probably some that reign longer than that, but we don't know who they are. The French King Louis XIV actually reigned longer than that, for 72 years, but his advantage was that he started reigning when he was 4, and Queen Elizabeth didn't do that. She is a wonderful person, becoming somewhat of an icon maybe globally as longevity, faithful leader. So teachers are kings, and all of you are teachers or will be teachers. And so we have that common ground, and we're going to be responsible for a classroom, our little kingdom. Now, Queen Elizabeth is a wonderful, you know, person, wonderful example of many things, but she is not perfect. I'll break it to you, she has made some mistakes. You and I will make mistakes. We just like to think about how teachers are like kings. You have the word written out there at the top of your notes, and we'll come back to that after a little while. There's an acrostic there. You can be thinking about some words that describe a king and also describe a teacher that we can throw in to the acrostic, and we'll cover that later, but feel free in your notes to jump down to those blank lines. You know, this whole thing of making notes for the binder is always a bit of a challenge for me. If I could, I would just supply you drawing paper and a drawing pencil and just let you doodle, because that's what I do with my notes. I write some things down too, but I draw lots of pictures as I listen. It just helps me listen better, I guess. So you're free to do that. Write down any ideas that you have along the way. Maybe your mind wanders while I'm talking and you have, you know, a great idea, or a quick to-do list that you're needing to do yet before school starts. Feel free to jot that down too. There's lots of space there, lots of lines. How are teachers kings? Well, a king has absolute power, and teachers have almost absolute power. You think of it in your classroom, you have almost absolute power. Now, that is a tremendous responsibility. It's a tremendous opportunity, and it's also really scary. You're the one that decides who goes first, where that other person comes in the line, who goes last. You're the one that decides who gets a chance and who gets a second chance. You decide. That's a lot of responsibility. Kings had absolute power back in the day. They made laws, and some of them on a whim, you know, would just make a law to take care of the problem immediately. Kings judge. The Bible tells us not to judge, but as a teacher, you are a judge. You're going to have to decide. Last week, we were working with Shenandoah Christian Music Camp in Ontario, and I was working with some volunteers, and the one volunteer, they came in from a soccer game, and she said, you know, I didn't know what to do. I don't really know soccer rules. There was this goal, but the one team didn't think it really counted, and the other team thought it did, and, you know, they weren't in the right place when they kicked the ball, and I didn't know what to do, so I just said, we're not going to count it. That's the sort of situations you get thrown into as a teacher. You know, because some of the little guys, they watch soccer, and they know all the rules that the professionals use. Well, it's hard to break it to them, but guys, this is not professional soccer we're playing here. It just isn't. And so you're going to have to judge. You're going to have to be a judge as a teacher. Kings must rule. Louis XIV, I don't know if he felt like it when he was 4 years old. Do you think he did? He wanted to be the king? They said, do we have a king here? And he put up his hand. He was 4 years old. No, he was thrown into it. He was the king. He became the king. And he had to rule, whether he liked it or not. When he was 9, he had to rule. He was the king. As a teacher, you must rule. You will rule. Now, you may rule well, or you may rule poorly, but you will rule. Okay? A king's main concern was watching out for kingdom interests, and your main concern will be to watch out for the interests of your school. Think of your school as the big kingdom, and there are some things in your school that, as a teacher, you have access to. But they're not just for anybody. You're a privileged person. You get to go places that the general public doesn't. Back in the day, kings makes me think of the king's forest. He often had a king, a forest, and not just anybody was allowed to go in there and hunt. Now, if you were hunting for the king, or if you had special permission, you could go there. But that was a very protected area, and you needed to be careful that you went in there and what you did in there. And as teachers, especially new teachers, realize that you need to protect the kingdom interests, the interests of your school. Let's think about that for a little bit. What are some of those things? Well, the first thing that comes to my mind are the children. In my case, about 15 or 19 sets of parents are going to entrust the most precious thing they have into my care for 5 and 6 hours a day. I need to protect that. Your school has a culture. Your school has a reputation. You are going to either contribute to that or detract. As a king in the classroom, or a queen, you need to protect the kingdom interests. Kings lead armies. As a teacher, you lead an army. Think about your classroom at recess. You're the one that leads them forth out to the soccer field, and it's not professional soccer. We talked about that. Try to tell my boys that it's not professional hockey in the wintertime. They don't buy it. We work on it. I make the rules, and we try to make them fair for everyone. But you lead the army. You decide who the general is. You decide who's going to be your bodyguard and who the lieutenant is. Kings lead armies. Back in the day, the king did. The king led the army, and often one of the tactics in battle was to try to kill the king, or even better, take him alive. So leading the army, you know, all of these things have their pro side, and they have their con side as well. But as a teacher, you lead the army. Another thing that kings did back in the day was to provide for the poor. And you often have these stories where this poor man that really needed some land, and he needed to be able to provide for his family and had nothing, would come and he'd ask the king. And the king, who was very, very wealthy and had access kind of to the whole kingdom and was the judge and absolute power and all that, could provide for the poor, and he would. And he could just kind of backhanded take care of the needs of the poor. I want you to think for a minute of the poor in your classroom. Think of it today and try to think about it again in a month and maybe in 2 months. Who are the poor in your classroom? Maybe the poor in spirit. Maybe the poor in academics. The ones that are actually economically poor. At our school, tuition is paid 2 times a year. I think through the first month and then sometime after Christmas, and they make 2 tuition payments and they're done. There are some families in our school that come often to me as the principal and wonder if they can do it monthly. Sometimes the 10 monthly payment plan isn't good enough. They break it down to a 12-month payment plan. And I was that family when I was growing up. My dad paid tuition all summer long, but he paid every cent of it. How can you help the poor? Those who are poor in sports. See, I make the hockey rules. When we've got some 12 and 13 year olds that think they need to score all the goals, then I add a rule, usually about middle of the winter, and this is the rule. Only the girls can score goals. Now the boys can pass to them, the boys can set them up, and we're playing together, and it's a lot of fun. And you know, the boys actually kind of enjoy it. It's an added challenge, and the girls love it. So look out for the poor, because you can, as a king, as a queen, provide for the poor. And you should. Kings are feared, teachers are feared, and remember that before you come down too hard, before you make a cut and dried decision. You are in a position of tremendous authority. You are feared, and that's a good thing, but temper that with a lot of kindness and understanding. Even when you think you're right, ask yourself this question, but what if I'm wrong? Teachers should be respected, and I think sometimes they're not respected enough, but we need to earn that respect. Like we heard already this morning, whether you like it or not, you live in the public eye. Kings did. And when the king got sick, everybody knew it. That was a big deal. That was something that you talked on the street corners and went ripping through the market, this news that the king is sick, he's not doing well. When the king's son, the crown prince, maybe was born with a deformity, there are these great stories of how they tried to hide that. Or when the young boy would, you know, go insane, or he was just out of control. All of the king's servants tried to shield that from the public eye, from people finding out. I'm not suggesting that you do that, but just understand that if you have 15 students, you're in front of them every day. They watch your every move. They perceive it and watch you, and I'm not going to say evaluate, but they think about what you're saying and what you're doing through a certain lens, and you're possibly the topic of discussion at 15 different supper tables. I love the little story about the first grade teacher that made a deal with this mother that if the mom didn't believe everything that the child said happened at school, the teacher promised that she wouldn't believe everything that the child said happened at home. Just kind of had this agreement that, you know what, they'll just kind of benefit of the doubt. But we do, we live in the public eye, for sure. I would ask you this morning, what is the single greatest influence in the classroom? Think about that for a minute. Do we have any brave souls that want to try to answer that question? Your example, very good. Anything else? See, there are no wrong answers here. We're just sharing ideas. The teacher's worldview, okay. All right. What about the curriculum? This is what I have said. The greatest single influence in the classroom is the teacher. Now, I worked in a school in Guatemala, in Central America, and the government of Guatemala required that every classroom only have one grade in it, and the teacher teaching the grade needed to be certified. And there were not a great deal of Mennonite certified teachers in the area, and so we brought some in. But what we ended up doing was hiring a lot of teachers that had just graduated, young people. They had grown up in the public system. They had never gone to a Christian school before. They had no idea what Christian education looked like. And so we often gave them a chance. And I would often say to them, I will give you your first year for free. You come, you teach, and we will train you. You're going to have to do it our way. But then after that, the second year, you have to figure out how this whole system works and really do what you've been trained to do, because otherwise somebody else is going to come along, another young teacher out of college, and is going to actually outperform you, and they're going to get the spot the next year. So for the first year, it was kind of a training school, and I learned so much from those teachers, from the young teachers. They would come, you know, young people, lots of ideals, more answers than questions even, and we would work with them, and it was great. One thing I often got to do was to sit at the back of their classrooms and watch them teach, and I would try to give them lots of good affirmation and point out what they were doing really, really well, and sometimes I'd give them a point or two on how they could improve. But the best part was when that teacher left the classroom and the next one came in. That is really fascinating. If you ever get to watch that, watch it with both eyes wide open. And you get to see what we're saying here, that the teacher is the single greatest influence in the classroom. One teacher would leave, and the next one would come in. The next teacher would come in, and those guys slouching in the back row would just sit up a little bit. And some of the handwriting would improve. Well, sometimes the erasers started to fly, and sometimes the erasers got tucked in. It was the same dysfunctional home back home. It was the same curriculum on the same rickety desks with the same crack in the wall and the door that hardly closed. Nothing had changed except the teacher. Teachers are kings. Here's a bit of a warning from James 3, verse 1 and 2. It says, "Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and sisters, because you know that we will be judged more strictly. For we all stumble in many ways. If someone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect individual, able to control his own body." This is a verse that has bothered me over the years, because I was a teacher from a very young age, and I enjoyed it. I enjoy teaching, and I often wonder how many mistakes I make a day in my speech. My brother-in-law told me a couple years ago, it's in the Spanish Bible, but a loose rendering goes something like this: "He who speaks much sins much." And I'd never run across that before, but that's pretty well what it says. Proverbs 10, verse 14 says, "Wise men lay up knowledge, but the mouth of the foolish is near destruction." So sometimes as teachers, we tend to speak foolish things. Brings me to a point, an opinion, I guess, that I'll share. You think about it. There is a weakness in the Mennonite church, I believe, in our Mennonite communities. And this is what it is, I think. We have a very structured and determined way that we choose leaders for our churches, and we should. That is good. Now, different communities do that whole ordination process a little different, but we are very intentional, very specific about the leaders in our churches. But in our schools, we'll take anyone we can get. And that's a weakness. I believe that a teacher who teaches longer than 3 years may affect the church more or as much as the church leaders. Because they are teaching the young, the very young. They are helping the youth develop their thinking processes. And somebody said here, the teacher's worldview. Who do you have? Board members, school administrators, people responsible for your church school, who do you have teaching there? Take a look at that. Think about that. Teachers, realize that your role and responsibility is great. It's a great opportunity, too, to sow truth, to plant good seeds. In Central America, a teacher is also a community leader. In Guatemala, 15 years ago, These teachers that would graduate from Teachers College were often 18 and 19 years old. It was more of a careers level program back then. And so they'd be young when they would go out to usually a far-flung public school, and they were the teacher. And especially the men, but also the women, were looked up as a leader in the community because they were going to teach the children how to read. They were going to change the statistics on literacy. Often they would do evening classes for adults to learn to read, for the illiterate adults. And in the communities, they were often looked to solve community problems. So if in the community there was no running water, it was kind of expected that, you know, the teacher would start working on that and begin the process, you know, make connections with the government agencies that could help and to give grants and to organize that, organize the community men to dig the ditches, to lay the pipe and bring running water to the community. Or if there was another need, the teacher was kind of looked to as the person that would have the know-how to knock on the right doors and fix a problem. I want you to think about that for a minute. You know where you'll be teaching, and you may know the community where you're teaching in. What is God asking you as a person, one person, you're just one person, what is God asking you to do for that community over time? I believe each one of you has a special individual calling to do and give your personal gift to that community and bring about maybe a very small change, but a change that builds the kingdom. Kings. Now we go to the acrostic. I'll give you some words, and with the words, I'll give you some homework. Keep thinking about it. There's a long line there behind each letter, and I'd invite you to just add in some other words that come to mind as they come. Acrostics is something that I like to use in devotions with my grade 7 and 8 students. It's a lot of fun. You throw up a word like that. I'm going to say crazy enough that I'll do it without having thought through everything. I don't have an answer for every blank when I put this up on the board sometimes, and it's amazing what grade 7 and 8 students come up with. I wish I would have gotten them to help me with this one. Kings are kind. Kings should be kind. Kings are intelligent, and they often were very, very intelligent people. And what they didn't know, they would ask, and they would find people that were skilled and trained in that area and learn. I almost said kings are nice, but nice is such a nice word, I decided to leave it out. Kings are neutral, and they should be neutral. As a judge, often they were the Supreme Court of one, that when the judges in the land couldn't figure out a situation, they'd take it before the king, and the king needed to be neutral. Kings are wise. You can write that somewhere in your notes as well. We are called to be wise. If any man lack wisdom, James says, let him ask of God, who gives abundantly, if we ask in faith. Kings are good. Now, you might say good and kind is the same thing. No, it isn't. And think about that word good. Can we be good all the time? And kings are sovereign. Kings are responsible for a lot of things. Kings are over the group. They lead the armies. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 6 and 11 tell us that the Old Testament is here for our encouragement. 1 Corinthians 6 verse 10 says, now these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Verse 11, now all these things happened unto them for in samples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. I would just like to look at some of the kings in the Bible and look at their lives. That's a beautiful thing about the Old Testament. We can read through in a matter of minutes several chapters and see the life progression and decisions and consequences that different individuals made, and we can learn from them. And that is what I would like to do this morning, is learn from three kings in the Bible and relate that to your teaching. I was going to ask you who was the greatest king in the Bible. Well, it's hard to say. We could argue about that for a while. But one of the great ones was King David. And the reason he was great is because he waited on the Lord. If you're discouraged, if you're in despair, if you're troubled, I would invite you to open the book of Psalms and read there how David waited on the Lord. He trusted. He had his doubts, he had his fears, but he waited and he trusted. David made lots of mistakes, and he did some really big mistakes, but he kept going. He asked for forgiveness many, many times, and God said, he's a man after my own heart. David was a man who waged many battles. And as teachers, we say, you know, we need to pick our battles. And I believe that, yes, we do. But you think about David, he had to kind of win every single one, right? And he did. Like, the man knew how to run a sword because he lived through. He had to live through each battle. He formed an elite band of warriors, and you can read about that. That was before he was king. And who were these warriors? They were outlaws, a lot of them. They were outcasts, down and outers, people that didn't make the cut for the king's army, or were disgruntled with the king, with King Saul. They'd come and they'd join David and his band, and they were amazing. You may have some outlaws in your classroom this next year. Can you pull them in and make an elite band of warriors that protect the kingdom interests? David killed Goliath. David did the impossible because he trusted in God, and he would not allow the name of God to be profaned. And he went up against something really, really big, much bigger than himself. He went up with courage and sort of blind confidence, we could say, and he killed the giant. There may be a giant that you need to kill this year, and I'll pray for you. David honored an unreasonable superior, and I hope that's not your case this year, but you may be called to that, to honor someone on your board or on your school leadership team that is nigh unreasonable. King David had many wives. Now, you do not have many wives, but you do have some priorities that sometimes conflict and are complicated. As a teacher, your work is never done. So when do you decide when to quit? Marking papers or preparing for the lesson. At least I find it that way. I could always prepare a little more. If I would have had another day to do this talk, I would have probably changed some things yet. But at some point, you've got to be done. And you have, some of you are married men. You have a family. You have a wife and children. Some of you are wives. You have a husband. Complicated priorities. David lived his life in the public eye. He made some mistakes in the public eye. One time he was celebrating and his wife criticized him for it, like strongly criticized him. She had a point. David was a man after God's own heart, like we mentioned. David overlooked sin in his children's lives, and that was not a good thing. He should have corrected them. He should have changed the course of history by being attentive to his children. Maybe the complicated priorities played in there. David prepared for many years to build a temple for the Lord. He gave his strength and his wealth to the next generation because the Lord said, no, you're not going to build the temple. You're a man of blood. Your hand has shed so much blood. I don't want you building the temple. David had planned and dreamed of that. And yet he was willing to lay that dream down. But he got behind the dream and he provided. He gave what he could of his strength and his wealth to the next generation. Are you willing to give your strength and your wealth of knowledge, of instruction, of example to the next generation? Because that's what you're called to do as a king, as a teacher. David's son was Solomon, and here are some things really quickly about Solomon. Solomon was young. He said, God, I'm a child. How am I supposed to lead this great nation? He realized the responsibility was too great, and if there's one takeaway from this session, this is it. Realize that it's too big for you. The sooner you get that one down, the better. If every morning finds you on your knees saying, God, this responsibility is too great for me, I need your help, then we can win. Solomon was king, and he didn't say, okay, good, I'm in charge, I'm going to put some things in order. My dad didn't know what he was doing. He said, I'm but a child, I don't know what to do. And he asked for wisdom, and God gave him wisdom and a whole bunch of other things too. He was the one that got to build and dedicate the temple. The school I teach in is an old kindergarten school, and it's so small and insignificant and awful that people driving by don't even realize it's a school. There are 100 students that go there, and people don't know. We have two portables, and it's just a mess. And they're building a new school, apparently. They've been building it for the last 10 years, but they're really getting close. And it's possible that we'll be digging in the next 2 or 3 years, and it's really exciting. I started teaching there 3 years ago, and I'm drawn back to this fact that some people that are still there, and some who are not, have worked hard to create what is going to be and what I enjoy now. Some people really, really worked hard for that. And I just kind of walk in and get to have it for free. The thing that David longed for and had to give up, Solomon achieved. Did Solomon deserve it? His father provided for it. He had the vision for it. Think of that, new teachers. You are getting to do what some people put blood, sweat, and tears into in order to get it to where you just walked in. All right? He had even more complicated priorities, poor guy. And he left the true God to follow false gods. And that ability is in me. That tendency is in me. And I'm afraid it's in you too. We need to keep coming back to the truth. Here's one I'd love to hear your opinion about sometime. Will we see King Nebuchadnezzar in heaven? I think we will. But this man was not a Christian when the story starts. This man was powerful. He was decisive. If I'm not mistaken, he was on a campaign taking kingdom after kingdom after kingdom when his father died. And he had to rush back to Babylon to secure the throne and kind of curtailed his campaign. He was very gifted. Incredible man. He was extremely intelligent, and yet he didn't know everything. And so he surrounded himself with wise men, and their job was to give him advice and to help him know what he didn't know. And you know, they kind of got a salary, 3 really good meals a day, and all they had to do was give ideas once in a while, or interpret dreams, you know, when he wanted them to. And if they didn't, they'd be beheaded. So other than that, it was a pretty cush job. He did this. He sought out people. And I would encourage you to do the same thing. You don't know everything. I don't know anything. I know one thing or two things. I know some things, but I don't know everything. I couldn't even get my computer to talk to the projector this morning. I mean, you see how vulnerable we are? We need people. You need gifted people, wise men and women around you to help you. He expected and demanded the best, and he got the best. And if he had to take off a few heads to get the best, well, he was willing to. Quite willing to, in fact. He didn't back away from taking young people from the royal lineage, from a foreign country and culture. And I'm going to say from what he would have considered to be a far inferior culture and kingdom. And he took them and he invested in them. He educated them. And not only did he teach them with the best, teach them his culture, his language, and all of that, he himself tested them. And that's in Daniel chapter 1, verse 18, 19, and 20. If you want to look at that, some amazing verses. Daniel and his 3 friends were found to be 10 times more capable. This is the group that was from an inferior culture. But he needed them, and he used them. He was powerful, he was proud, he was pompous, and he repeatedly needed to recognize the sovereignty and supremacy of God. Teachers, you are kings, but we are under the authority of others, and ultimately the King of Kings. This is a poem that I came across in the last 2 years. I love poetry, I've read poetry for years, but this one I had not found, and I don't know how or why, but I did find it. I find it interesting that Edward Rowland Sill names this poem, entitles this poem Opportunity, and I would like to say it to you. And you think about your work as a teacher, and you think about the battles you're going to need to fight this year. And think about the tools. There's a broken tool or two maybe at your school. Think about that. This I beheld, or dreamed it in a dream. There spread a cloud of dust along the plain. And underneath the cloud, or in it, raged a furious battle. And swords shocked upon swords and shields. A prince's banner wavered, then staggered backward, hemmed by foes. A craven hung along the battle's edge and thought, had I a sword of keener steel, that blue blade that the king's son bears? But this blunt thing, he snapped and flung it from his hand, and lowering, crept away and left the field. Then came the king's son, wounded, sore bestead, and weaponless, and saw the broken sword, hilt buried in the dry and trodden sand, and ran and snatched it, and with battle shout lifted afresh, he hewed his enemy down and saved a great cause that heroic day. What was worthless to one won the battle for another. I asked my students this year, which one are we? Are we the coward or are we the prince? We're all called to be the prince. We can win the battle even with broken tools. God bless you, and we'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.